Tonight, Secrets of the Unified Field, Joseph P. Farrell, our special guest. We're looking at the Philadelphia Experiment, the Nazi Bell. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell had a very early interest in physics, mathematics, music, and placement in an accelerated mathematics program until college. There, he became interested in ancient texts, an interest that led him to a PhD in patristics from the University of Oxford in 1987. His interest in utilizing modern science to interpret ancient texts and esoteric traditions continued throughout his studies. His father, an engineer, first piqued Joseph's interest in the Great Pyramid during a family vacation, and it has led him to push his life through various different kinds of research and investigations. He's a noted author as well, Secrets of the Unified Field, one of his latest works, Joseph P. Farrell. Hey, Joseph, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on. I've been a Coast fan for many years, so this is a great honor and pleasure for me.
Yeah, my pleasure, too. What is patristics?
Well, patristics is the academic study of the early church fathers up to about Thomas Aquinas in the Western Church, and then about the 14th or 15th century in the Eastern Church. It's a very broad kind of discipline. You have to study a lot of languages, a lot of philosophy and canon law and things like that. So it's kind of an intense type of degree.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about your latest work, Joseph. We're going to concentrate a lot on the Philadelphia Experiment and in the Secrets of the Unified Field, but tell us how you got involved in this.
Well, actually, Coast to Coast played quite a role in that. You had a show on about, I think it was about 5 years ago. You interviewed a man by the name of Drew, Howard Strom, and a lady by the name of Deborah Cunningham.
On the Philadelphia Experiment,
And it was a breathtaking show. I was just absolutely spellbound, because what they did was they went and discovered a lot of the logs of the Tarazed, which, of course, was the ship that Carlos Miguel Allende actually served on. And, of course, he's the man that wrote those now famous letters to Morris Jessup, in which he outlined the experiment. And they basically had come to the conclusion, examining these logs, that Allende was actually telling the truth when he said that this was an experiment performed at sea. And, you know, I listened to the show that night. I was absolutely kind of spellbound, and so I rushed out the next day, and I placed an order for the booklet and received that in the mail, and I read that, and that kind of convinced me that my own interest in the Philadelphia Experiment, I'd better pursue that, you know. So that's kind of how I got interested in the story. And in tracking it down, I ran into the work of some scientists that had actually performed an experiment, kind of a proof-of-concept experiment, and they more or less verified many of the salient details that Allende had mentioned in his letters, and so that's kind of how the book came to be.
Well, I got to tell you, I think we went looking for those two,
and
we can't find them.
Well, you know, George, that's the funny thing. I did, too. You know, I placed the order for the booklet, and when they were on the show, I remember them very pointedly making the statement that they were planning an entire book on the subject, you know, the first one in many years that had been written. You know, Berlitz and Moore wrote their famous book about the Philadelphia Experiment many years ago. And so I placed an advanced order for the book. I went to their website. I saw the book cover, you know, and the projected title for it. And when I tried to track them down, it just like, you know, just like at Coast to Coast, I couldn't find them. I had all my letters returned. So I thought, well, you know, I'll put their research, you know, kind of try and summarize it, because it really was very extensive and so well done. So I tried to kind of summarize it in the book, and I hope, you know, if anybody knows who they are, or, you know, even if they're listening, that they'll get in touch with me, because I'd be very interested in talking with them.
Of course, and as you know, we have had on this program numerous times Al Bielek, who's up there in age right now.
Right.
Yeah, what an incredible story there, Joseph.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, this is one of the most fascinating things about the work of the engineers that I talk about in this book, in that they managed to verify, again, experimentally, by a proof-of-concept experiment, some of the salient features of Allende's story. And one of the things that they mentioned in their paper, and I reproduce this in the book rather extensively, is that with the kind of physics and mathematics that they think was behind the experiment, and I think that they're right, that some sort of time displacement may have been possible. So, you know, the whole experiment kind of breaks open with their work, and I try and reproduce that as well in the book, too. So it's a fascinating story.
How did you tie in the secret Nazi weaponry and the Philadelphia experiment?
Oh, boy. You know, that's really an excellent question, and I think it goes to what was happening in Germany between the wars. You know, you had a series of physics papers that were published in Germany beginning about 1921 with the publication of a paper by a German mathematician named Theodor Kaluza. And I know you've had Michio Kaku on several times.
Yes, and Art's had him many times.
Right. And, you know, Dr. Kaku talks a lot about the Kaluza-Klein theory and how it plays a role in the formation of string theory. Well, what this theory was, it was a five-dimensional theory. It was a hyperdimensional physics model, you know, very similar to some of the models that Richard Hoagland has proposed. And in this theory, basically what Kaluza did is he unified the equations of general relativity and the equations of electromagnetism in this higher dimensional theory. Well, then Einstein comes along in 1928 and kind of expands on this idea in his own unified theory paper, in which he incorporates a mathematical tensor transform called the torsion tensor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think this is a crucial key to these two experiments in the following way. Einstein, when he published his paper, he makes it very clear that he thinks that this theory may be the way to replace general relativity. In other words, he himself has a certain dissatisfaction with the theory that made him famous. But even more interestingly, there was a Hungarian genius by the name of Gabriel Krohn. I talk about him a great deal in the book. And what Krohn did was he was an electrical engineer. And he noticed that some of the anomalies that many electrical engineers will tell you about in networked electrical systems, they will kind of creep and, you know, give you anomalous energy that they really don't know where this is coming from.
Right.
Well, what Krohn did was he took Einstein's torsion tensor from his unified field theory papers, and he applied it to electrical engineering. Now, you know, this was absolutely unheard of because, of course, up to this point, this kind of mathematics really only was kind of theoretical. It only applied to stars and planets and big things. Well, he brings it right down into the laboratory bench and says that this is the way we can explain what is happening in these electrical machines. Now, this is very significant because what he's really saying is, even if the unified field theory is incomplete, number one, it's engineerable. And number two, you can only explain some of these electrical phenomena by a kind of a hyperdimensional physics model. Well, Krohn publishes a paper in 1935 about this basic idea, and he wins a prize at the University of Liège in Belgium. And, you know, this is right 2 years after the Nazis take power in Germany.
Okay.
So what I speculate is that this could not hardly have gone unnoticed in Nazi Germany, because what he's really said is we have the key and the theory and the means to engineer space-time locally. And the same thing would have been noticed in America because Krohn eventually makes his home here in this country. And there's a certain amount of data to suggest that his thinking is actually to some extent behind the thinking of the engineering of the Philadelphia experiment. So really what we're dealing with here is this Nazi bell on one side of the war and the Philadelphia experiment on the other side of the war, and they're both scientifically rationalized from this same hyperdimensional physics model.
Joseph, how far were the Nazis, the Germans, mm-hmm. ahead of the entire planet at the time?
Well, you know, this is one of the big mysteries, George, of the war. I think that they were very far ahead. In fact, a friend of mine, a colleague that researches the Nazi bell, his name is Igor Vitkovsky. He lives over in Warsaw. And he's really kind of the one that broke the story of the bell first. You know, Nick Cook relies a lot on his research, as do I. And the problem that is manifest when you start studying this is that they were at least four decades ahead of the kind of physics thinking that was being developed elsewhere.
Including us?
Well, including us, with the possible exception of the Philadelphia experiment. But there is one difference, I think, between what the Germans were doing and what we were trying to do in the Philadelphia experiment. When we achieved the results that we did, and I think that by and large, Allende's allegations in his letters are substantially true. I think that those things did happen. The invisibility of the ship and being able to see the hull and the water and so on and so forth.
And sailors stuck between two dimensions, possible?
Well, you know, that's one of the more interesting things that he mentions in his letters. He never refers to them being buried in bulkheads or anything like that. That's kind of a surprise to most people. It certainly was to me. He never mentions that in his letters, but he does mention that sailors who were in this experiment, when they were subsequently exposed to a magnetic field, would oftentimes simply disappear right in front of you, you know. So, yeah, it appears that they were caught in some sort of hyperdimensional boundary condition, if you want to call it that. And I think what the difference between the two experiments then is that we achieved these results, but we really weren't looking for them. We crossed some threshold where these results were manifest, and we really weren't expecting them. The Germans, on the other hand, I think, designed this Bell experiment with the express intention of looking for these types of very anomalous hyperdimensional effects. So there's the crucial difference. But in all other respects, I think that they were ahead in the sense that they had rationalized things out a little bit more completely than we did in the Philadelphia experiment.
Joseph, let's spend some time
and
get your take and definition on the unified field, first of all. Let's give everybody this perspective of what it is.
Okay, well, historically, the unified field is the attempt to unify the geometries that you find in general relativity of gravity and then the geometry of magnetism. And essentially, the difference between the two, if you want to think about them in kind of simple terms, is that the geometry of gravity in general relativity is spherical, and the geometry of electromagnetism would be kind of a donut or a torus shape. So the attempt was to unify those two things. Now, physicists will tell you that the reason that these theories were ultimately rejected was because in quantum mechanics you have two additional types of forces, the so-called strong and weak nuclear forces. So there's actually four forces, and the unified field theories of the 1930s really only unified two of them. But again, you know, this goes back to the work of Gabriel Krohn, because what he was adamant and insistent upon was, even though these theories might be incomplete, they were nevertheless electrically engineerable. And that is quite the crucial key to understanding these two experiments.
Okay, now as we move then into the Nazi Bell, let's talk more about that.
Sure. Okay. Well, the Bell, for those who aren't aware of what it is, it was the most highly classified secret weapons research project in Nazi Germany. And in my opinion, I think, George, it's probably the ultimate basis behind the whole legend that the Nazis came up with some sort of flying saucer, or if you will, a UFO type of technology. I think.
Well, might they have had, though, reversed engineered technology? Do you think they had a captured craft?
Well, there are stories that something like that crashed in the Black Forest around 1936. Now, I've attempted to track these stories down for any number of years, and I really haven't found any evidence to suggest it. But there is one interesting bit of information. In 1929, Benito Mussolini actually established a secret kind of version of Magic 12, almost, a secret UFO study group in fascist Italy. And I even reproduce some of these documents in one of my books called Reich of the Black Sun. And the purpose, the whole purpose of this group really was to do nothing but study UFOs. And the man he places in charge of it is none other than Guillermo Marconi. So in other words, at least one of the Axis powers, namely Italy, had an extreme interest in the subject. So it may be that all of these stories that we hear of some sort of crash and recovery effort by the Nazis, it may be that, you know, something like that happened in fascist Italy. We simply don't know. The documentation really isn't there. But, you know, if we assume for a moment that it did, then we have yet another impetus and another basis of explaining why, in the space of 12 short years, the Third Reich was able to come up with just some absolutely phenomenal technological development.
I mean, they just exploded.
Yeah, they did. They really did. And that's about the best way of putting it. They literally exploded in terms of technological growth.
Okay, now, with the Nazi Bell project, how do you tie it into the Philadelphia experiment?
Well, essentially, both projects, if you examine them, and I try to do this in the new book, if you examine what they're relying upon, they're both using rotating magnetic fields. This is quite the crucial key to the Philadelphia experiment, and it's also the ultimate rationalization behind the Nazi Bell. And this tells me, in turn, that both sides, with their respective experiments, are really thinking out some of the implications of this torsion tensor that you find in some of these unified field theories of the 1930s. And let me kind of explain, maybe for those who don't really understand what torsion does, let me give kind of a simple analogy. If you take a soda pop can and empty it, and then wring it like a dish rag in opposite directions, you're going to kind of spiral and fold and pleat the soda can. And that's essentially what torsion describes. It describes this spiraling and folding and pleating of space-time itself. And it really is kind of the basis of so much thinking in this field of hyperdimensional physics that you know, it really kind of boggles the mind once you start it. But that's about the best analogy I can come up with to kind of picture it for people.
Okay, all right, we understand that. And so you're saying simultaneously, while the Germans are working on their incredible projects,
right,
we're working on the Philadelphia experiment.
Right. Right. And essentially, both sides are rationalizing on the same basis. In other words, they've both concluded, and I think probably because both sides had to have been aware of the work of Gabriel Krohn in saying that, you know, these unified field theories aren't just theory. We can actually apply these to the practical realities of electrical networks and electrical machinery. And I think that really is the crucial key. Because, you know, if we examine the claims of Allende, who always insisted, and you know, this was one thing that he says over and over again in his letters, is that the Philadelphia experiment was based upon Einstein's unified field theory. Well, you know, Einstein published several papers, different versions of his unified field theory, but the one that ties to the way the experiment was actually set up is this 1928 version with its idea of torsion.
Okay, now, somewhere along the line, there's some time travel involved in this, Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere, don't you think?
Well, there have always been these allegations. And interestingly enough, when I went looking actually into the Allende letters, he himself does not say this. This is something that emerges in the Philadelphia experiment legend much later on. So you never find this in the original version of the story, and actually you really don't even find it in Berlitz and Moore's book. But one of the most interesting things, the engineers that performed this proof of concept experiment, they presented a paper, and basically they said that on the basis of torsion, it's theoretically possible. So even
right,
those
let's talk more about that, Joseph, when we come right back. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Joseph Farrell, our guest. Joseph, back to the time travel, the time goddess, when you're ready to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things, George, that I ran into in doing this book was there, of course, are the persistent rumors surrounding the Philadelphia experiment that some sort of teleportation or time displacement or perhaps both occurred. But in examining the documentary record and trying to find some scientific rationalization in the scientific literature for it, I simply couldn't find that. Allende never mentions this. But what is really intriguing to me is that we do find this in reference to the Nazi secret weapons projects. And this kind of stunned me. And to kind of set it up, way back, I think in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the well-known novelist Dean Koontz actually published a novel called Lightning. Mm-hmm. And the whole topic of the novel was that the Nazis had invented some sort of secret weapon that made time travel permissible. And unusually, he even describes this thing as involving a rotating drum. Now, you know, this is one of those odd synchronicities, you know, because this is precisely what the bell involved. It involved rotating drums, very high electrical potentials, and so on and so forth. And there's a researcher by the name of Henry Stevens, another just excellent researcher into the subject of Nazi secret weapons. And he mentions and I reproduce this in SS Brotherhood of the Bell. He mentions a story that was told to an associate of his by someone in NASA, a German scientist in NASA, that claimed that there had been some sort of project involving the manipulation of time inside of Nazi Germany. And interestingly enough, you know, when it came out, more and more came out about the Nazi Bell, one of the code names for the Bell project was precisely Project Kronos, which of course means Project Time. And there's even an interesting little bit of kind of esoteric or astrological significance to that, because Kronos, of course, is also the Greek word for Saturn, the planet. So, you know, if the Nazis are investigating this unified field theory and the technologies to manipulate the fabric of space-time, then they're really doing one of three things, and I think probably all three together. They're investigating the potential for some sort of field propulsion. They're investigating the idea of free energy, or if you prefer, zero-point energy or vacuum flux energy, whatever you want to call it. And the third thing they're doing is they're investigating it, of course, for the potential to weaponize it, to make it some sort of weapon. So, you know, in all of these things, time figures predominantly, because torsion, of course, is a way of manipulating the fabric of space-time. So I think, you know, unusually, all the evidence seems to point to something concerning an experiment in time involving the bell inside of Nazi Germany. But it's definitely there.
What were they going to do with the Nazi bell?
Well, this is really an excellent question, and it's probably the $64,000 question. Everything that I've been able to research in the three books that I've talked about the bell points to these possibilities. The first thing I think that they were really interested in was to have some sort of prototypical technology that would give them the ability to come up with a flying craft that was so far in advance of anything their enemies or potential enemies had available to them that they would be able basically to strike anybody on the planet at will. Fortunately, the war ended before they were able to get it to that stage. I think the other thing that they were doing, there was an SS department that was more or less in charge of the bell, and it was called the Entwicklungsstelle 4. That basically means Development and Research Bureau. And the brief of this particular department was to come up with some way of making Germany energy independent. In other words, their whole focus with part of this project was to be able to draw energy directly from the vacuum, you know, shades of Nikola Tesla.
That's interesting, because they were desperate for fuel during the war.
Oh, yes.
And in many cases, I think the lack of is another reason why we beat them.
Yes, absolutely so. You know, this is another one of those hidden aspects of the military history of the war, George, that really don't make sense unless you have some knowledge of these German secret weapons projects and what's motivating them. And you're exactly correct. And I think that this really is one of the, has to be one of the ultimate rationalizations for the Bell experiment. But then finally, of course, you know, Nazis being Nazis, is that they're going to want to turn this physics and this technology into some sort of weapon.
Yes.
And any time you say that you have the ability to manipulate the fabric of space-time, to engineer it, what you're really saying is you've got the potential for a weapon that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match. So I think they're really after all three of these things all at the same time. And when we look at the Bell, we're looking at kind of a prototype technology as a means of entry into each of these three areas.
Well, our first atomic bomb had that big look to it, but
yes,
it could have looked like a bell.
Yes, and you know, this is the other aspect of this story that is so fascinating to me, because the man heading up the Bell Project is a Nobel laureate physicist by the name of Dr. Walter Gerlach. And he's also, by 1944, the head of all of Nazi Germany's atom bomb projects. And
uh-huh.
I happen to believe that their atom bomb project was actually much more successful than we've been told. So, you know, this man is involved in a lot of things, and it says something when the Nazis have classified the Bell higher in their classification scheme than the atomic bomb itself.
What happened to this developer after the war?
Oh, boy. Excellent question. Oh, boy. He, you know, George, his specialty in physics was gravitation, magnetic spin resonance, magnetic vortex compression, and all these very, very strange areas. In other words, he's the perfect scientist to be heading up something like the Bell. But interestingly enough, and Nick Cook comments on this at some length, as a matter of fact, in his book called The Hunt for Zero Point, and I know
right.
You've had him on the show.
Yes, good man.
And yes, he is, and you know, he's done his homework in that book. Because one of the things he points out, George, is that after the war, Dr. Gerlach remained in Germany, he resumed his university posts and so on, but unusually, he never published another scientific paper relating to any of the subjects that were his specialty. And he comments in his book that, you know, it's as if something had frightened or scared Gerlach beyond all reason. And it is very unusual. You know, how do you account for the remaining 30 years of this brilliant scientist's life, and he never once touches, you know, touches that subject again?
Let me ask you this one.
Mm-hmm.
This was being done, assuming they didn't get it from reverse engineering.
Right.
They were developing it.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about today, 60-year-old technology.
Yes.
That was occurring then.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to it? Did it go black ops? Is it undercover? Because if they were close to developing something dramatic, whether it was a weapon, the ability to bend space and time, to perhaps do anti-gravity propulsion.
Right.
That was 60 years ago, Joseph.
Oh, yeah.
So let's assume that that has secretly been going on for 60 years.
Well,
what kind of shape would we be in now technologically?
Oh, boy. You know, this is another excellent question because, you know, if you extrapolate from what they actually achieved with this device toward the end of the war and project 60 years down the line, then there is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that this technology has been brought to a great state of sophistication. And you mentioned another interesting thing in your question. You mentioned the fact that did it go black ops? Well, this is really one of the most astonishing aspects of the Bell story, because at the end of the war, the general who is the actual head of the project, an SS general by the name of Hans Kammler, he goes entirely missing along with the Bell and all of its project documentation and a massive six-engine, heavy-lift, ultra-long-range German aircraft called a Junkers 390 that was capable of flying nonstop from Europe to Argentina. So, you know, the path of the Bell leads possibly to one of two places. It either leads to this country and disappears into its black projects, or it disappears into Latin America, into some post-war, ongoing, independent, secret Nazi research project. You know, and this raises the whole possibility and prospect of an alternative and secret space program. I talk about that at great length in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And I kind of came, you know, oddly enough, I kind of came to similar conclusions that Richard Hoagland has come to in Dark Mission. You know, he's kind of approaching it from the historical point and working his way back to the early 1960s and late 1950s.
Right. I'm going to bring Richard on the third hour with you for a little bit. So I'm just going to have you two talk for a little bit. I think this would be just historical, so we'll do that, Joseph.
Sure, excellent.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, he kind of back engineers the history and the politics from the standpoint of all the anomalies that he and the Enterprise mission have uncovered, you know. And I'm working my way forward. Well, you know, it's kind of strange because we're writing our books at more or less the same time.
And we're going to meet.
Yeah, and more or less the same, come to the same conclusions, you know. So to me, this is yet another indicator that there is a strong possibility that this two space programs hypothesis is indeed what is going on. And, you know, in that respect, I want to mention something that I point out in the new book, The Secrets of the Unified Field. It's at the very end of the book. But, you know, Berlitz and Moore, they have a picture, a relatively famous picture, of the Office of Naval Research Committee that was responsible for America's first satellite program, the Vanguard satellite. But when you look at this picture, George, you see two Navy officers that were involved in the printing of the Varro edition that referred to the Philadelphia experiment. And standing in the center of the picture, you see the president of the company that printed that book. And, you know, it's that book that really gave rise to the whole Philadelphia experiment story. But interestingly enough, on the other side of the table, sitting kind of to himself, kind of looking like he's holding court, is Dr. Wernher von Braun.
You know, the plot thickens,
you know. So you have to speculate, and I do so in the book, that Dr. von Braun is possibly one of the very men that received a copy of this book that detailed the Philadelphia experiment. And as if that's not enough, one of his cohorts, you know, one of the Nazi paperclip scientists that we bring over during Operation Paperclip is a fellow by the name of Dr. Kurt Davis. And I have a picture of Dr. Davis and Dr. von Braun at the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral in my book SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Now, what's so interesting about that, and this dovetails so nicely into Mr. Hoagland's two space programs hypothesis, and that there is an actual covert secret space program inside of NASA. Well, Davis is kind of the living icon of this, George, because Davis is the flight director of the Kennedy Space Center there during the Apollo project. And more importantly, as my research uncovered, Davis is the man that developed the power plant for the Bell.
How about that?
Yeah.
How about that?
You know, he's not even...
you were talking about the fellow who took off with the Bell.
Yeah.
How do we know he didn't go to Area 51?
Well, we don't. You know, the only other good alternative, really, for General Comer to go to would be precisely this country, because we would have the resources to protect him and shield him and give him new identities and so on and so forth. And being the man in charge of this project, of course, he would be the perfect one to know all about its various ins and outs and details and so on. And there's one more interesting fact I should mention in that respect. When the war ended, the British took all of Germany's famous atomic bomb scientists and took them to a place called Farm Hall and recorded their conversations. And at the end of this, I think it was about 3 to 6 month period, they let all of these scientists go except one, who was brought to this country and interrogated for another 3 months. And his diaries are classified to this day. And guess who that fellow was?
Oh, gosh, who was that?
It was Dr. Walter Gerlach.
Oh.
So, you know, as you say, the plot thickens. But, you know, when you add all these pieces together, I think you have to conclude that you can only pile up so many coincidences before they're no longer coincidences.
Well, and as you know, Joseph, I don't believe in coincidences.
Yeah, exactly. Neither do I.
On the inside of your book, you've got a black and white picture, which is very fascinating to me. It's got Albert Einstein sitting there mm-hmm. with two military folks next to him. And, you know, I would have thought, you know, maybe some experts from other universities would be there with him. Mm-hmm. Instead, there are two military personnel with Albert Einstein. I wonder what they're asking him.
Well, you know, this is another thing, George, that's very, very peculiar. Einstein did work for the U.S. Navy during the war, you know, and it's precisely this service branch that is responsible for the Philadelphia experiment.
Yep.
And what?
And he's talking to a captain, and I can't see the stripes on the guy standing.
I think the other one is a commander, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, we're dealing with some senior officers here. And, you know, as you say, what are they talking about? Well, my guess is that Einstein at some point, you know, with his involvement in getting the Manhattan Project started, well, it's only natural that during the war his expertise is going to be sought in some of these projects. But he really wasn't a nuclear physicist. But, you know, with this idea that the unified field theory may have been the rationalized basis of the Philadelphia experiment, as Allende has always insisted, then it stands to reason that the Navy would have consulted him during the development stage of the experiment. So, again, you know, this is yet another one of those non-coincidences.
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to getting you and Richard together in the third hour, Joseph, the third hour that you've been on with us, the fourth hour of the program.
Right.
I've got to tell you, you know, I listen to Richard intently when he's on the program, and I read his books and his material, and I accept a lot of what he has done over the years. And I first got interested in him when I picked up, you know, his books on Cydonia and monuments and Mars and everything else. This talking to Richard and now talking to you, for me, starts to make a lot of sense on why there is a black ops program.
Well, yeah,
it makes sense. It really now makes sense.
Yes, and you know, the really interesting thing that he brings out in Dark Mission is this landing of certain Apollo missions on Hitler's birthday. You know, I read that and I was just dumbfounded.
That is weird. Well, stay with us. I want to ask you about Morris Jessup and the case for the UFOs when we come right back. Joseph, tell us about the Vero edition and Morris Jessup.
Well, this is the book that actually began the Philadelphia experiment story. Morris Jessup was a famous astronomer back in the early 50s, and he was also one of the very first scientists that became interested in the field of ufology. And he wrote a kind of a popular study, an examination, basically, of UFOs and other strange things that he called The Secret of the UFOs or The Mystery of the UFOs. I forget the exact title. But one day he gets a postcard in the mail that's written in this strange scrambled English, And it tells him about the Philadelphia experiment, and he kind of writes it off as a hoax, and then he gets yet another letter, and this, of course, is the very first of the letters that Carlos Miguel Allende actually sends to him. And again, he tries to find out a little bit more about it from Allende, who doesn't really communicate too well. But in the meantime, a copy of his book is sent to the Office of Naval Research. Again, the same committee that, you know, had that strange picture of von Braun and these men that received this copy of Joseph's book.
Okay.
And in the book, there are all these very strange annotations in the margins. And I reproduce a great segment of the Vero edition in my book because it's something that most people have heard about that know about the story, but they haven't really got access to it. So what this committee did, what these naval officers that got this book did, is they contacted the Vero Company in Garland, Texas, which is right outside of Dallas, and had them print up a very short, limited run of Jessup's book with the annotations. That's the Vero edition. It's named after the Vero Corporation that actually did this book. And they circulated it among the committee and gave Jessup a few copies of it for himself and asked him to kind of be involved in the project. And in the book, in these annotations, there are two very strange allegations that are made. Number one is, of course, the story of the Philadelphia experiment, that the Navy actually made a ship invisible and that it was keeping it more or less under great secrecy and under wraps. The other thing that's very, very strange, and it just leapt out at me when I read it, is that the annotators also refer to a very ancient cosmic war, and they tie the science of the Philadelphia experiment to the technology that was used in that war. So, you know, I've written a book, in fact, entitled The Cosmic War, and, you know...
I'm not gonna let you go without talking with you about this.
Well, you know, it just really took me for a loop, George, when I read this, because I was really not expecting to see anything even remotely like that in the annotated edition. But, you know, putting yourself in the Navy's shoes for a moment, they get a copy of this book in which it's alleged that they performed some experiment during the war, and they actually achieved optical invisibility of an entire destroyer escort. You know, we're talking about a 5,000-ton ship here. And not only that, but they're also talking about UFOs and flying saucers and how it's all the same technology. And, oh, yes, this stuff was once used to fight a very ancient war. Now, this has got to pique the Navy's interest.
Now, was this ancient war here? Now, when you say cosmic war, was that still an Earth war with ancient civilizations, or did this happen out in the cosmos?
Oh, I think it was on Earth and in our local solar system neighborhood.
Okay, okay.
You know, this, again, it goes to some of the work of Mr. Hoagland, you know, in dating not only the Mars anomalies, but the moon, and more recently, the very strange moon of Saturn named Iapetus, because, you know, there's every indication that all of these things are indeed artificial. So, you know, what do the authors of the Vero edition know? And to even talk about cosmic wars and read ancient texts in that way, you have to be familiar with those texts. And,
sure,
you know, Carlos Allende just does not seem like the sort of person that would be. But interestingly enough, in this edition, they mention the fact that they're gypsies and that this is somehow a part of their lore, of their tradition. So, you know, you put all this together, the Navy's getting this book talking about disappearing ships, flying saucers, anti-gravity, and cosmic wars. So you know that it's bound to pique their interest just for those reasons alone.
Of course.
And, you know, standing right in the middle, or pardon me, sitting right in the middle of the table of this committee is none other than Dr. Werner von Braun. So, you know, it just dovetails in so many different directions. It's really quite astonishing.
And he told his aide, Carol Rosen, Dr.
Right.
Carol Rosen,
right,
of the existence of extraterrestrials, and also he mentioned what the Illuminati was going to do and create this fictitious war with them
right.
in order to control us.
Right. And, you know, that's yet another little aspect of this story that is so very peculiar. You know, when you dig into this, let's just look at the record here for a moment. We have, you know, with the appearance of Mr. Hoagland's book, Dark Mission, you have a cogently argued, well-documented case that there is some sort of not only covert space program, but you have a documented case that many aspects of that program are indeed controlled or influenced by what, for all intents and purposes, is an esoteric or occult agenda. But dovetailing into that, there's always this idea of some sort of hidden, off-the-books technology that's also in play. Now, I found that fascinating when I was reading the book because, to be honest with you, I had to read the book twice. But, you know, I found more or less the same thing when I was researching all of this business about the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell. What do we have in Nazi Germany? Well, we have the attempt to create the beginnings of a space program. And what do we find when we look at it carefully? Well, we've got the rockets, of course. We've got the V-2, the V-1, and then the projected rockets, the intercontinental rockets, which I even think there's a strong possibility that some of those were actually tested prior to the end of the war. So you have a kind of a secret but public program that is very visible in the form of falling rockets on London. But with the Bell, you have an even more secret program that is trying to develop a kind of physics that would lead to field propulsion, to a wholly different kind of technology for space travel. So it's beginning to look to me like there's a strong possibility that this two-track space program actually has its roots during World War II. And, you know, once we said that, then we've really crawled way out on a limb. But I think that's where the evidence has to take us.
Yeah, under Jessup's work, he also talks about levitation.
Yes.
Let's explain what's going on in that area.
Well, Jessup was really a fascinating man once you read his book, and I try and reproduce as much of it as I can in my new book. He was an astrophysicist, so he's looking at all of these strange things, the Bermuda Triangle, the very mysterious plane crashes and ship disappearances that occur there. He's looking at the ancient monuments in Peru and Egypt and so on and so forth, and trying to explain how it is that a supposedly primitive peoples can actually engineer these monuments that just would defy any modern-day engineer to do. And he comes up with the idea that it had to have been accomplished by some form of levitation. And in seeking a scientific rationalization for all of these different phenomena that he's investigating in his book, he hits upon the idea that it's got something to do with Einstein's unified field theory. Now, George, to me this is fascinating because when he wrote his book, of course, the academic community just all but hounded him out of you know, circles of respectability. But in point of fact, he's really so far ahead of his time, and yet at the same time, he's really saying basically the same thing that Gabriel Krohn was saying, that this theory, even though it's incomplete, is an engineerable theory. And I think this, too, is what had to have caught the U.S. Navy's attention when his book arrived at the Pentagon.
All right, let's move on a little bit more. Of course, Charles Berlitz was one of those responsible for giving us the great information
right.
on the Philadelphia experiment, but
right.
also the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, the connection here, again, I think, lies in some version of these late 1920s unified field theories, and more particularly with the idea of torsion. And the reason why is, just to kind of explain it a bit, general relativity basically does not allow or even take into consideration, really, any kind of local variation of gravitational acceleration on the surface of a planet. So in other words, you don't have the theoretical possibility of a place of extreme gravitational or magnetic anomalies like the Bermuda Triangle is. But when Einstein comes out in 1928 with a unified field theory that has as one of its central components this idea of torsion, he once again introduces into theoretical possibility the idea that there can be such locally anomalous areas of magnetic and gravitational attraction. So, you know, Jessup hits upon this as an explanation for the Bermuda Triangle, and that's kind of what gets him, and for that matter, Berlitz, involved in the Philadelphia experiment, because this is what Berlitz uncovers when he starts researching it. So, again, we're going right back to these unified field theories and this higher dimensional physics.
It's amazing, because many of the things that Jessup writes about, later on, other writers would pick up on his work, like Zechariah Sitchin and people like that.
Yeah, he's Jessup, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because Jessup, in a certain sense, is decades ahead of the alternative research community by mentioning these possibilities. He's really kind of the first one, George, that I think had the courage to stick his neck out there and say, well, we've got to explain all of this stuff too, and the conventional models are just inadequate to account for it.
Oh, no, I agree with it. And I remember reading some of Berlitz's accounts of some of these stories. Fascinating by it, and one of the reasons why it pushed me in the direction I'm in now, Joseph.
Yeah, well, the same here with me, George. You know, Berlitz, I read his book on the Philadelphia experiment years and years ago, and then, of course, that got me interested in his Bermuda Triangle book. And it was the same thing for me, and especially, you know, the indications that run throughout his books that this all has something to do with these 1920s and early 1930s unified field theories, and that's kind of what set me off on it.
Did anybody ever find Carlos Allende?
Oh, yes. One of the strange episodes I recount in the book is that he actually surfaced at the Varro Company in Dallas, Texas. And this was after Berlitz and Moore's book had come out. And, the Berlitz book on the Bermuda Triangle, I should say. And he shows up at the Varro Company and basically demands hush money, you know, from them not to talk about it anymore. And then he comes out and publishes a series of articles in magazines in the 1970s in which he says that, well, my letters were all a hoax, and then turns around a little bit later and says, oh, no, they weren't. You know.
Jeez.
So, yes, he definitely surfaces, and if my memory serves me correctly, he just died very recently.
Well, God, I would have loved to have gotten to him.
Oh, yes, me too.
My God. Where did Tesla stand during any of this?
Well, this is another aspect of the story that I found very fascinating. The engineers that I referred to that performed this proof-of-concept experiment, they did this in the early 1990s, and they published a paper called Tesla's Egg of Columbus and the Philadelphia Experiment, and they presented this. It's a rather technical paper. They presented it to the International Tesla Conference in 1994. And in this paper, and I reproduce this in the book, they mentioned that in World War I, Tesla had presented to the then Undersecretary of the Navy, who just happened to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had presented an idea to the Navy of a means for deflecting torpedoes from U-boats by means of a rotating magnetic field. And these engineers speculate that this was probably the real basis, ultimately, that led to the formation of the Philadelphia Experiment. Because the man that was, of course, in charge of President Roosevelt's many scientific research projects during the war was a fellow by the name of Dr. Vannevar Bush. And he was very well acquainted not only with Tesla's work, but with this very proposal that he had presented to then Undersecretary of the Navy. So, you know, we have all of these connections that would indicate that at some point, and like Berlitz and Moore mentioned, Tesla was involved in the project up until about 1943 when he died. So again, you know, you have these connections that are there, and it stands to reason that the Navy would have done this experiment. In fact, if you look at it in a certain way, George, they would have been derelict in duty not to have done it.
Why are there then so many rumors about the Eldridge, what happened? Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the movie, the Philadelphia Experiment, really kicked it into high gear.
Yes.
But where do we get these incredible stories of sailors half in and half out of a ship and things like that?
I think that part of it has to come from the physics itself. In other words, the potential for all of these things is certainly there, even though they're not part of Allende's original story. And, you know, this is one of the things that these engineers point out in their paper, is even though these other allegations aren't part of the original story, it is a remote theoretical possibility of the physics that's behind the experiment. So I think that's ultimately where you have to go. And I think, you know, a certain amount of it has to be, you know, people just jumping on the bandwagon and hoping to make a quick buck or whatever. But even then, I think we're still dealing with the potential that something like that may have happened.
Do you think someone like Ole Al Bielek really was on that ship?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't even really go into his story at all in the book.
It's a great story.
Oh, yes, I know it is. I've heard him many times on your radio show. And, you know, I don't go into it simply because my approach in doing all of my books has always been to stick as close as I can, not only to the documentary evidence, but as close as I can to the scientific rationalization that evidence suggests. So I kind of leave the question open as far as that goes. I don't really even get into it in any detail. But again, as these engineers point out, the torsion tensor is capable of explaining or at least making possible some sort of displacement along the time axis of an object, namely a ship. So again, you know, you can't rule it out of court at all.
And then we've talked with Duncan Cameron, who claims that he was Al Bielek's brother during the experimental phase, changed his name since he's been here in this time period. Again, part of the puzzle that just makes this story even stranger.
Well, you know, if you put the puzzle pieces together in a particular way, it does seem that something like this is possible. There was a fellow, a scientist, on many years ago, I think Art Bell had him on, by the name of David Anderson, who was actually a very serious credentialed physicist, that had come up with an idea for some sort of time machine in which he was going to manipulate very minute portions of time by using a system of rotating lasers. Well, you know, once we've said that, we're right back in the ballpark of the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell, because both experiments were rationalized on the basis of rotation, and that really is the key to this higher dimensional torsional physics.
Let's get involved now. Let's go out into the cosmos when we come back, Joseph Farrell. And exactly, Joseph, what was Albert Einstein's role in all of this?
Well, obviously, the first and premier role is that he's the formulator of perhaps the most famous version of the unified field theory, which would be the one that he formulated in his 1928 paper. But I think we have to go beyond that. You know, we do have these strange connections of Einstein to the Navy, and that means, in my opinion, that he was brought in perhaps to serve as the technical consultant to doke out and tease out some of the mathematics that were suggested to the Navy in Nikola Tesla's project of a project to deflect torpedoes. So in other words, one of the things that emerges in the Philadelphia experiment, and I think this is precisely where Einstein was brought in, and some of his associates, incidentally, I think that one of the rationalizations that the Navy had for performing the experiment was to deflect projectiles. So in other words, we're dealing with kind of a 1940s version of Star Wars, if you stop and think about it. And again, that plays into so many different areas of contemporary research and science. So I think that's probably where his role lied.
And then Wernher von Braun?
Well, this is really the interesting part, because in my previous book called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I point out that in the Magic 12 documents, in the White Hot Intelligence Estimate, The paperclip scientists are explicitly referred to as being brought in by the military to look at this crashed craft. Now, to me, that suggests a very different take on the Roswell crash than originally was suggested, and certainly the one that's popular in the ufology community. Because I don't think if the military had suspected that this was a genuinely extraterrestrial craft, that they would have shared this secret with their recently defeated enemies. And even Colonel Corso suggests that there was something about this craft that looked like familiar German technology, and that's the reason they were brought in. So von Braun, I think, if we put all the evidence together, we have on the one hand his probable reception of a copy of this Varro edition of Jessup's book, and on the other hand, we have him as one of the scientists brought in to look at this crashed craft in Roswell. So in other words, this is a picture entirely consistent with what we see emerging inside of NASA. The Nazis have their hands in almost every sensitive pie that concerns space matters that exists inside of this country.
Albert Einstein would have been about 129 years old right now.
That's right. That's right.
Can you imagine that if you were still alive with this age of computers, what he'd be able to do?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it really kind of boggles the mind when you think of the fact that Einstein performed most of his experiments and most of his theories entirely in his head. So, yeah, you're right. You know, if he had had computers, what would it be accomplished?
Oh, unbelievable.
Unbelievable, truly.
Okay, so give me your take, Joseph, on what you think happened in the 40s with the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, I think that, you know, your guests that you had on back in 2003 were correct. I think that the experiment, first of all, was performed at sea, and that this was the final stage of a series of experiments that had led up to this point. And they suggest they suggested in the interview, in fact, and then in the booklet, that the results were not anticipated when it was performed at sea. Now, interestingly enough, what they also pointed out was that when it was performed very close to Bermuda. So what happened, I think, was that for some unknown reason, when they did the experiment in its full-scale version at sea, they'd performed all the trials and tests up to this point, and they were successful. And I think what they were trying to do was really achieve some measure of radar stealth rather than total optical invisibility. But that for whatever reason, given local celestial conditions and other things that you have to factor into consideration with this kind of hyperdimensional physics, that these elements played a role in the unanticipated results, and that the experiment ran away and achieved some truly, truly breathtaking results that the Navy really didn't expect. And I think that your guest back on that show nailed it right on the head. And interestingly enough, what happened to the experiment, they also indicate a very peculiar thing, and I reproduce this documentation in my book. They suggested that the reason the Navy lost the experiment is that it was somehow shifted or sidelined into the U.S. Coast Guard. Now, you know, when I read that, I thought, well, of course, where is the last place on Earth that anyone is going to look for a black project like that? It certainly would be, you know, it certainly wouldn't be the U.S. Coast Guard. But they reproduce this document in their little booklet that shows that many of the logs concerning the Eldridge and the Terrazed that they were searching for had been checked out of the National Archives by someone that was attached to the United States Coast Guard. So it's, you know, the story is just very strange any way you examine it.
You know, Einstein was opposed to us having an atomic monopoly.
Right.
Instead, what he wanted was he wanted to equip the United Nations with nuclear weapons.
Right.
So they could maintain the deterrence.
Right. Well, Einstein's role in all of this is very peculiar, and I'm glad that you mentioned this, because one of the strangest allegations that Carlos Allende makes in his letters is that when Einstein proposed his unified field theory, he then retracted it because he was afraid of what humanity would do with it. And it's almost as if Allende is suggesting that somehow Einstein either knew about or later became familiar with some of the results of the Philadelphia experiment and then retracted his theory because he was appalled at what had happened during the experiment.
Let's talk for a moment about the cosmic war,
okay,
that story. But where do you get the book, Secrets of the Unified Field?
Well, it's available from either Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or Borders, or if they want to order the books directly from the publisher, that's Adventures Unlimited Press, and they do have a 24-hour credit card number. That's area code 815-253-6390. And there's a toll-free line that they can call during normal business hours. That's 1-800-718-4514. And I'd like to point out that if they place orders on three or more books, then there is a 10% discount directly from the publisher.
Okay, great. And Lex, you might want to put that 800-718-4514 number down on the website link that you have with Joseph Farrell, if you would. This is my way of communicating to my webmaster. High technology,
yeah.
Right? Nah, I've got computers and I'm hooked up. I mean, I'm like the bionic man over here in the cave, Joseph.
Well, I am too.
The cosmic war.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that. And how did you uncover this?
Well, actually, it was something that was kind of suggested to me, not only by Zechariah Sitchin's works, but there was an interview, I think, that Mr. Hoagland did back in 1998 with Art Bell and another gentleman, in which he briefly mentioned the possibility that we might even be looking at some sort of very ancient war on an interplanetary scale. And that got me to thinking because, of course, you know, you find adumbrations of that throughout many of the ancient Sumerian and Egyptian texts. So I decided to start looking at those texts a little bit more carefully to see if they had or could be viewed as containing some sort of physics that would be sophisticated enough to blow up that planet that is now the asteroid belt. And lo and behold, when you read the text in that way, it certainly does indicate that there was something like that in existence millennia ago. So, you know, it's truly a fascinating subject. And then, of course, Dr. Tom Van Flandern had published his book about the exploded planet hypothesis. And he pinpointed two dates, George, and these really kind of leapt out at me. He pinpointed dates of either 65 million years ago or about 3.2 million years ago. And it's that latter date, if you compare it to the Hindu epics, to the Sumerian epics, dovetail almost exactly and perfectly with these ancient texts. And that really got me started writing that book.
Well, you know, it is amazing how the Vedas, for example,
oh, yes,
talk about and describe a nuclear holocaust,
yes,
between Earthlings, of course.
Yes.
And, you know, Michael Cremo is a believer that civilizations did this a long time ago as well.
Oh, yes, I am too. And, you know, the interesting thing that Sitchin writes about in a book that he wrote called Wars of Gods and Men. You know, I'm not a subscriber to many of the details of Mr. Sitchin's work, but he makes a very interesting suggestion in that book that there was a super weapon that had to be destroyed that was capable of wreaking regional destruction on Earth and elsewhere. And that in this war, nuclear weapons were used by the side that did not possess that weapon. And I found that just, you know, an incredibly astonishing assertion to make. And what really kind of threw me for a loop was that Sitchin never really even pursued his own insight. And, you know, that was another little kind of motivation for me to write The Cosmic War, because I thought, well, gee whiz, if we're lobbing nuclear bombs around the Earth and Mars and anywhere else, just to destroy an even more sophisticated technology, then what was that technology? And, you know, the ancient texts are just full of some very, very interesting suggestions.
The Giza Death Star Destroyed, the book that you wrote, is that tied into some of this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the questions I get a lot is, why do I write books about Nazi secret weapons, the Philadelphia Experiment, Cosmic War, and Great Pyramid as a weapon? Well, all of my books have as a basic theme this higher dimensional physics. And once we accept that physics, then what are the implications for the history we've been taught? So they all have to deal with that kind of peculiar interface. So, again, those books kind of play into this overall theme that we've been talking about tonight.
And you believe the pyramids were used as weapons?
Well, not all the pyramids. I think at the minimum. You know, I don't hold that hypothesis dogmatically, but I do entertain it because this is what the texts themselves and some of the aspects of the structure of the Great Pyramid in particular seem to suggest. At the minimum, I think Chris Dunn is absolutely correct. I think it was a machine of some
a power plant. Right?
Yes, I think that you have to look at his conclusions based on the engineering of the structure and come to the same conclusion. It was some sort of machine. Where I think, perhaps to a certain extent, that he may fall short is that I think we have to explain its machine-like properties not in any conventional way. We have to explain it as a kind of a hyperdimensional machine that is designed to tap into, again, the energies that are present in the fabric of space and time for whatever purpose. But once we have a technology that's able to do that, then we can certainly weaponize it.
Now tell me though, how was it used?
I think if we look at the structure and the Giza compound as a whole, which I show in the book, is laid out in a very, and Mr. Hoagland's going to love this, is laid out in a very tetrahedral geometry.
You know, you guys use the same jargon, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the pictures I reproduce in that book is a rotation of the compound along an axis that runs right down through the Great Pyramid, and I rotate it through 120 and then 240 degrees, and what you end up with is a schematic of the Star of David, which of course is a two-dimensional analog of two embedded tetrahedra. So, you know, the whole compound embodies the geometry of this hyperdimensional physics, and on this score, Mr. Hoagland is absolutely 100% correct. So, you know, I got to thinking, well, if this was indeed a weapon, as some of these texts seem to suggest, then what happened? How did they use it?
And who did they use it on?
And who did they, more importantly, who did they use it on?
I mean, it's aimed up. Maybe they're shooting it into space.
Right. Well, I do think that probably it was used off-world, and I think some sort of weapon of that nature had to have been used to blow up that planet, after all. If we attribute that planet's explosion not to natural causes, but to a war and to a weapon, then we have to have a physics sufficient to be able to do that. And standard nuclear bombs just are not going to do it. Neither are lasers or anything of that sort. So we'd have to have a hyperdimensional physics that is able to tap into these energies of space and time. And that, I think, basically is how that thing was used.
That is incredible. And what about the technology to make it? Where did it come from?
Well, this is another aspect that I get into in the Cosmic War. But basically, I think the technology is terrestrial. In other words, that it was made by humans. But one of the interesting things that the texts point out is that the human genus may not be confined to this planet. So, you know, in saying that, you know, we've opened up the extraterrestrial possibility. But the other thing that is very interesting in those texts, George, is that they make it very clear that at the end of this horribly destructive cosmic war, some of this technology was deliberately removed from this superweapon and either destroyed or used elsewhere, or in a very few cases where the technology could not be destroyed, it was hidden. And the texts themselves point to, hold on now, basically three locations where it might be found: Egypt, Iraq, and Mars.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What about it being in the Hall of Records at the base of the Sphinx?
Well, it could be there, too. You know, again, the whole...
That's Egypt.
Right? Yeah, that's Egypt. And the whole Giza compound, as you know, is just honeycombed with underground chambers and tunnels that really haven't been explored. Or if they have, the Egyptian government isn't talking about it.
No, they'll never do that.
Yeah, they'll never do that. And I find it very interesting, you know, that Zahi Hawass has taken the step to wall off the compound. And, you know, the cover story is that they're trying to protect it from vandalism and terrorists. Well, you know, those pyramids have withstood the test of millennia and earthquakes and wars and everything else, and they're still there. And I don't think a terrorist with a suicide bomb or a fertilizer bomb is going to do much damage to those things. So I think there's some other agenda in play there, and I certainly think that the same is probably true in Iraq. I think that there is some sort of agenda in play to recover some of this lost technology that may be there.
William Henry believes there's a Stargate out there.
Well, again, you know, it's very interesting that you mention William's work, because this plays into this type of physics very directly and very definitely, this whole idea of torsion and time displacements and so on. So, again, I think, you know, we're looking at different pieces, basically, of the same puzzle.
Well, next hour we'll bring Richard C. Hoagland in, and then we'll take some phone calls for
sure.
You as well, Joseph. It is fascinating work.
It is endlessly fascinating, and you know, you investigate it, and it just goes so many places.
I didn't have time to ask you, and let's see if you can squeeze this in 30 seconds. You write about the death of George Patton, General
Yes.
George Patton. How come?
Well, you know, many people find it suspicious, but I think that General Patton probably was murdered because his advance units that went into these secret installations in Nazi Germany would have given him field intelligence reports on what they were finding. So the one man in the American command structure who had more or less a complete picture, as complete a picture as the Nazis had, would have been General Patton.
And he may have been too much of a rogue, huh?
Exactly.
All right. We'll be up next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Joseph Farrell, Secrets of the Unified Field. And, of course, joining us this half hour, Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, DarkMission.net, and also now best-selling author of Dark Mission, Hidden History of NASA. Richard has paralleled Joseph's work, both of them, over the years. You've heard Joseph mention Richard several times tonight. I thought it would be kind of fascinating to have both of them just chat with each other about what we're talking about. We've extracted a lot of information from Joseph, but I want to hear Richard's take on some of these. Hey, Richard, how are you, my friend?
Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Richard. It's really cool
to sit here in my office surrounded by all these screens, watching all this data, working on some surprises we have at Enterprise, and listen to someone who is so good at describing what he's found and has such credentials and such process to actually have found what he's describing. I mean, it's not every day that I get an Oxford Don to extol the virtues of my hyperdimensional model.
No, not at all. And when he mentions that verbiage, you must be jumping up and down.
You know, Robin is staying up. She was absolutely exhausted until Joseph came on the air. And she's been sitting there quietly listening, excited at times, because, you know, Robin's not a technical person like you and I are, Joseph. And you've really made it 3D for her. She sees these patterns, and she is such a hard task mistress. I mean, the hoops I have to jump through when I find something and show it to her, and the level of evidence and support. So you're at least winning one major convert tonight.
Well, that's good.
All right, Richard, I'm going to just let you and Joseph chat about both your theories here and kind of pop in and out, and then I'm going to take calls with Joseph in the next 20 minutes or so.
Okay.
But go ahead. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, one of the things that struck me in listening, Joseph, to you and George talking was that there really is a convergence now of independent, separate research. I mean, you and I,
yes.
I mean, I didn't know you existed until Tim Ventura, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, introduced me to you and your work.
Right.
And I wound up giving all six or seven. I mean, look, you write faster than anybody I know, including Isaac Asimov. And in fact, you're writing faster than I can read what you've written, which is really a problem. But I was able to bundle together six or seven of your works and give them as Christmas presents to some of our other Enterprise associates, our dear friends Nick and Dana. And I'm just listening to you and George, and I'm saying to myself, every once in a while, someone in this field comes along who really gets it, like from top to bottom.
Well,
and George, what is so eerie and at times frightening is that Joseph has written things in these books that I have independently come to believe but have not put down in print myself yet. And that's an extraordinary validation, because it means that when two minds are working on this set of data and set of notes and archives and ancient texts and all that, and we basically come to the same gestalt, we come to the same picture, that's the basis of real science. It's called peer review. The problem with this whole field, gentlemen, is that we don't have many peers.
No.
You certainly can't look at the mainstream. I mean, that would be a bastardization of the definition.
Yeah.
And there are so few people in this so-called New Age alternative community that have the rigor and the perception. I mean, yeah, it's nice that Joseph has a PhD from Oxford, but frankly, Joseph would still be Joseph doing the same caliber work if he didn't have any degrees. Because real science isn't born of degrees, it's born of inclination, curiosity, and an absolute self-imposed rigor to demand the highest level of finding the truth from within yourself, so you don't accept false data, weird data, fake data, and if you do speculate, you freely label it. And Joseph and I have had this running debate now, is the Giza complex, is the Great Pyramid specifically, as he has proposed in these three books as part of his series, a weapon, or, as I believe, it was built for some other remarkable hyperdimensional machine-like purpose. I certainly agree with him and Christopher Dunn that it was and is a machine, as does Stan Tenen and a few other of the real guys in this field. But I'm not so sure about the weapon hypothesis as a starting point. It may have been, as most human things wind up being, converted by some very bad guys into a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be that part of the soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
But my take on the physics is that the Great Pyramid was built, and it was built in a hurry to do something of an emergency nature. And the reason I say that is because if you look at Chris Dunn's work, you find that his bottom line is the pyramid was not built by, you know, hundreds of thousands of slaves dragging stones up ramps and all that. It was built by an ancient high-tech civilization, not the current Egyptians or their lineal antecedents, but somebody else. And it was done with extraordinary high technology, and his evidence is that in the coffer, which is that box in the king's chamber in the center of the pyramid, and at several other places in the construction, he is able to demonstrate, bringing out data from Flinders Petrie, who was the grandfather of Egyptology from England back in the last century, 18th century, I'm sorry. 19th. He has found evidence of mistakes. Remember, Joseph,
right.
He found those saw cuts?
Yep. Right.
That he thinks were made by ultrasonic saws.
Yes, right.
And if you're thinking, you know, a bunch of sweating slaves dragging something back and forth, like you see on TV, these logging contests.
Yeah, not going to happen.
That's
not going to happen.
But whatever technology was used to cut this granite was going through it at such a rate, one could properly use the metaphor, a hot knife through butter.
Yep.
And it looks like they actually made mistakes. And they took the saw out, and they made another cut next to it, like any carpenter that doesn't, you know, measure three times.
Yeah, like you
that.
See two saw marks on a piece of wood or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. Now, what that implies, Joseph, which I think goes against your weapon hypothesis, is that whoever was doing this was in a hurry. Even with that incredible precision of multiple levels of constants
mm-hmm.
and dimensions and
mm-hmm.
locking into the whole hyperdimensional etheric torsion
right.
framework of, in essence, the universe, they were making mistakes.
Right.
Now, that implies an emergency. That implies that maybe the whole textual stuff that's come down to us through thousands of years, probably 13,000 in this case, has gotten warped a bit. And the weapon idea has been conflated together with the pyramid maybe as an antidote for the weapon, to preserve the earth, to preserve the physics of this planet, which was the last refuge that anybody could live without technology in the entire solar system. So Joseph and I are agreeing to, at this point, given the sparsity of the data, to disagree about endpoints, but to agree that the search and the information gathering and the reading, the close reading of the text, and the obvious idea that there was someone who came before, some incredible high civilization that preceded what we see as legacies in Sumer and Egypt, etc., that is all true. But the actual soap opera, as I want to term it specifically, I don't think we have near enough information to make categorical decisions, and I think Joseph agrees with me at that level.
Oh, absolutely.
Richard, what if it was an asteroid deflector?
Oh, like in that one episode in Star Trek?
Yeah.
Well, you know, asteroids have become the current flavor of the month. Remember, the physics we're talking about is much more insidious and dangerous than an occasional asteroid.
Right.
And before 65 million years ago, if Tom and I and, you know, Mike and some other people are right, there were no asteroids. You know, now, here's another interesting thing, Joseph. I am having a very intriguing debate with Neil Adams, you know, via email. And, George, you remember who Neil is because you gave me his contact info. Neil is the cartoonist who was a contemporary of, I can't remember his name at the moment, major cartoonist who created the Fantastic Four and the Hulk and a whole bunch of other stuff back in the 50s. Anyway, Neil has taken to championing the work of Warren Casey, who was a Australian geologist who believes in the concept of the expanding Earth. And we've had these interesting discussions going back and forth, back and forth. Well, I have new data from the hyperdimensional model that says that the expanding Earth is probably correct, and it's not just limited to the Earth. Right. If the Earth has been expanding over, you know, millions and millions of years, so has every other body in the solar system. So has the solar system. So are other stars. So are galaxies. This is not limited to just our local neighborhood. Now, if that's true, Joseph, this comes back to the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the bad guys and you wanted to blow up a planet, what is the quickest way to blow up a planet if, as a matter of natural physics, energy is coming into a rotating planet, adding new mass and expanding its surface area?
Right.
You basically want to somehow technologically put a cork in the bottle.
Right.
And like with an old steam kettle, if you tie down the safety valve on, think of an old steam engine, you know, tie down the safety valve, the engine will blow.
Right.
Steam pressure. So suppose the pyramid was really designed in a hurry to put the cork in the bottle to screw up the resonance so that instead of the energy quietly creating new matter in the core of the Earth and the Earth expanding at about 3 millimeters per year, which it's doing right now, suppose it was designed to interfere, and that's the deadly deed. It isn't an overt weapon. It is a covert weapon that when you turn it on, it simply screws up the natural physics, and someday things go boom.
Right. Right. Oh, I don't have any problem with that. In fact, in the Cosmic War, I mentioned the possibility, based on the textual evidence, that what we're looking at with the Great Pyramid may, in fact, be a subsequent development to something that was previously there.
Well, and the key clue that this weapon thing is not that far out is that you know about the granite plugs in the passages inside.
Right.
They don't belong there.
Right.
The standard Egyptologists have got all kinds of wacky theories to explain them, and they can't physically explain them in terms of sheer mechanics.
Right.
How did they get them in there? They can't explain them in terms of why, because they don't fit that kind of a paradigm. You know, it's just as easy to cut around them, which is actually what Al-Mamun and his guys did when they were trying to explore the inside. So if they were trying to stop up, you know, access through tomb robbers and all that.
Right.
That didn't work.
Yeah.
But suppose it was designed to change the acoustics so the machine
Bingo.
Could never resonate as it was supposed to.
Bingo.
They were beamed in.
Yep.
George, this is a technology which is, as our dear departed friend Arthur C. Clarke said so many, many times, you know, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Mm-hmm.
When you can engineer reality, when you can actually change the base of what we think is real, and it's a real physics, which, of course, is a heart breath away from magic, then you can do anything.
Yeah.
And consciousness becomes the ultimate arbiter. And now we go back to Forbidden Planet and the secret science of the Krell and monsters from the id. And Joseph and I are having a wonderful time. And should I kind of give part of the story away, Joseph, tonight?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, and also the cartoonist, Stan Lee, right?
No, it wasn't Stan Lee. It was Jack Kirby.
Jack Kirby.
Jack Kirby, which is an extraordinary story that some night you and I should go into because, oh, have we learned some things. Anyway, Neil is a contemporary of Jack Kirby, and he is brilliant. I mean, you've had him on the show a couple times.
Yep.
He is brilliant because he's realized that Casey had this crucial idea and was right. But what's been missing is the energy source to do it, and that's where our work and Joseph's work, and I mean, this is all converging from so many different directions as we approach this mythic date of 2012. You know, as Art used to call it, the quickening. The quickening is happening in so many areas, even in the mainstream, even in this incredible election process we're watching. I mean, I'm calling this our first hyperdimensional election. Because I've never seen, in the entire time I've been following politics in the mainstream, I've never seen all the polarities that are amplified simultaneously across the board. This is a stunning moment to be alive, and it's only going to get better. You know, it's one of those things that the other thing that Art used to say, you want to take a ride? We are on one heck of a ride. So here's the news that Joseph and I have to announce to the country tonight. We have decided in some fashion that we're going to work together.
Yep.
And we're going to work together on the sequel to Dark Mission. Mike Barra is literally on his way from Los Angeles to spend the weekend working on the outline for the next book, which somewhere in the title is going to have the phrase, The Secret Space Program. Because what is so cool about Joseph's work is, A, it's independent. B, it's incredibly scholarly and referenced and footnoted and meticulously documented, and you can take it to the bank because there are documents, there's memos, there's governments, there's intel investigations, there's a whole archive that opened up when the two Germanys were reunited in 1989, and on the basis of that, we can say almost categorically that the research into hyperdimensional physics and torsion wave physics, which is the basis of anti-gravity, the basis for any real space program, was born and matured even before World War II.
Yeah.
And the Nazis losing, and I put that in parentheses, seems to be one of those great facades of history.
Yeah.
Because as Mike and I demonstrated in Dark Mission, no, they popped up in the American space program, and he regaled you with this astonishing bit of information that one of von Braun's key right-hand guys, Kurt Debus, who was really an electrical engineer, he was in charge of the high-voltage electrical aspects of the Bell experiments over there in Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
He was brought over here as part of Paperclip, and then suddenly he wound up. Remember, he's not a rocket guy. Why is he put in charge of Cape Canaveral, from which all the NASA rockets, including the Apollo missions, left to go to the moon? There's a huge unknown part of that story, which we will continue in the sequel to Dark Mission, and somehow Joseph and his extraordinarily, you know, ineffable work is going to be involved front and center, and that, as Paul Harvey used to say, is the rest of the story.
And you know what? When they had this technology 60 years ago, Richard, it's definitely gone black ops.
Well, remember what I was able to give to Art to sit on, that piece of videotape from SDS-48 and STS-80.
Right.
Showing those incredible hyperdimensional anti-gravity vehicles tooling around in Earth orbit.
Yes.
Being photographed and monitored and studied by instruments in the cargo bay of the space shuttle. That was not aliens. Those aren't UFOs. Those are our guys. Now, what Joseph and I are hoping by the time we publish this next book, which will be in about a year, that we can nail down, based on his sources, my sources, is who is actually running the secret space program. Because it may not be NASA.
Right? That is the big question.
A false front Western town.
Yep.
Richard, thanks for popping in. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Joseph, go break the leg. You're doing a heck of a job. And I'm going to sit back and enjoy the rest of the hour.
Well, thanks for coming in, Richard. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you later today.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to be back with phone calls now with Joseph Farrell on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, I enjoyed listening to your chat with our dear friend Richard C. Hoagland.
Well, it's very interesting, and I do happen to agree with him. I think that there has to be some sort of hyperdimensional aspect to the Great Pyramid, and I even suggest in one of my pyramid books that it may have been some sort of defensive weapon, and the way that one would tell that would be to date it appropriately based on knowledge of hyperdimensional physics. So I think that, again, you know, we're dovetailing in a lot of areas with our research and coming to more or less the same conclusions.
Okay, let's go to the phones.
Sure.
We'll pick it up by going to our first wildcard line, John, Washington, D.C., which is where I will be in a few weeks. Hi, John, go ahead.
Good morning. Kind of odd, as I'm coming into D.C., I passed NSA and Goddard Space Flight, and they must be listening because I couldn't pick you up at all. I was wondering, that with the knowledge that they knew that Saddam was, like, pretty close to the Sumerian tablets and his ancestry, could this be the weapon of mass destruction that he was talking about?
Well, as a matter of fact, that's an excellent question, John, and I even speculate on similar lines in my book, The Cosmic War, because you'll recall the Baghdad Museum looting incident.
Yeah, that's one thing I was wondering, too, because they got robbed.
Well, and, you know, it's very interesting because prior to our invasion, the French and Germans had teams of archaeologists in Iraq at the behest of Hussein's government. And when we invaded, we told them to get them out of there, which, of course, they did. But I strongly suspect that either the French or the German intelligence services were behind the looting and went in there and got some things that they had discovered. And I've entertained the notion, Jim Mars is another one that suspects the same thing, that perhaps one of the reasons that we were cloaking behind the idea of weapons of mass destruction was not necessarily modern weapons, but we were actually after some ancient things because that's what Saddam Hussein was after. So I think you're dead on there, that that's a possibility.
There was a tablet when they say it was a rocket ship.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the Packat tablet from there,
well,
and it looks like a guy sitting in a machine of some sort.
Oh, now that is from Lord Pakal, isn't it? From the Americas. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a Mayan ruin, and I actually reproduced that in the Cosmic War. But I think
it's striking.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. It was just striking to me because as you were talking, I was thinking of that tablet, and it does kind of look like you could look at that and think it was some kind of anti-aircraft gun of some kind.
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about what that is, but you're right. That tablet does seem to suggest some sort of technology in play. But when we're talking about Iraq, one of the things I talk about at great length in my book, The Cosmic War, are the so-called Sumerian tablets of destinies, because these were the objects actually of technology by which these Sumerian gods fought that war, and they go missing very clearly in the Sumerian epics. This is recounted, and I reproduce all this in the book. They go missing at the end of that last war, so I strongly suspect that something of that nature was in play with the French and Germans being there, and more importantly, with our invasion.
First time caller line. Go ahead. You're on the air with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Gentlemen, enjoying the show this evening. Thank you. I sent an email to you with a JPEG of it. I've created a device which is capable of generating a massive gravitational wave. Mm-hmm. It'll bend light into Einstein rings. If you were to roll a bowling ball across a floor, you could push a button on this box and it'll stop, bring it back. Additionally, if you had a video image of that bowling ball rolling across the floor and hit the video image of it at another location, you could change the direction it's going from another location. I believe it would be able to deflect an incoming object out of its orbit. If you look at this JPEG I sent you, it's not a Photoshop job. And I'd like you, if possible, to pass this along to Richard and possibly have a shot at examining it further.
Sure. I will certainly take a look at it and certainly pass it along to him.
If you're familiar with Einstein rings, ordinarily, Einstein did predict that was the first proof of his theories, was the light being bent and the visibility of the stars behind the sun.
Right.
And I was working on some metallurgy, and I accidentally made this strange alloy, and any electromagnetic wave passing through it creates a massive gravity effect.
Hmm.
And if I'd invite you to look at the photos, and feel free to contact me.
I will certainly do so, sir, and I'll pass it along to Mr. Hoagland. And it's interesting that you mention the bending of light. Of course, the famous British physicist Sir Arthur Eddington was actually the one that did that experiment that confirmed general relativity. But what most people don't know is that many of the values of that bending that general relativity predicted were not found by Arthur Eddington. In fact, some of the values actually ran counter to the predicted values of general relativity. So there's yet another aspect to this hidden physics history, and that's certainly one of them.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Robert from Los Angeles.
Hey.
And I'm in my car in Pacoima right now, and you two guys are really close to figuring this out, I'm telling you. Because I worked for defense a long time ago, and I did research and development, and what I used to do is when it was Russian equipment, I'd figure out exactly what they were doing, and I'd write it down, and then I wouldn't be able to talk about it again. Right. People who know who I am, I have a code number 1934, and letter S is the first letter of my last name. I'm going to declassify right now something, the most important piece of information. You guys are going to figure it out. That's what's I'm going to release it. Whoever submits this information, I'm going to say, is going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. Those devices, they're in Egypt. They're on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Look at this. Richard, you understand radio communications, how crystal radios work, how a crystal is cut to a specific frequency in order to work?
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Right.
Those pyramids, at the time those pyramids were built, the Earth at one time, when the dinosaurs were on this Earth, is a much smaller Earth. That's why the continents have pulled apart. The planet is expanding. It's getting larger. At the time where these pyramids were created, the Earth was at a certain size, a little smaller than what it is right now. And they were cut. They're crystals, like in a crystal radio. They resonate at the exact resonance of the Earth. It keeps the Earth stable. In order to have a planet with life on it, you have to build pyramids that are cut to a specific frequency that resonates to the Earth's resonance frequency. Planets that do not have pyramids have that eye at 19.6 degrees, I believe, on it, which is complete devastated weather in those areas. Those pyramids are resonant, keep the resonance characteristics of Earth stable, so there's a geological earthquakes and stuff. Whoever figured this out, put those here in order to keep the planet stable for life to exist. On Mars at this time, those pyramids were put on Mars. At the same time, they're cut to the exact same frequency of the resonant characteristics of that planet. So I figured this out 20 years ago. I talked to some people in the government, and they passed it on to the Pentagon. They kept it quiet. But you guys are going to hit it. And whoever submits this is going to get the Peace Prize.
Well, as a matter of fact, Saturday, make sure you're listening to Coast, because our guest with Ian Punnett will be Neil Adams, that you just mentioned, Joseph, some time ago.
Right.
And he's talking about the expanding Earth theory as well. Mm-hmm. You're very close, Bob. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Let me make one additional comment to what
Absolutely.
He said there. It's been one of my theories, and I mentioned it very briefly in the last pyramid book, but the torsion tensor is capable of describing the lattice displacements or defects in crystals. And it's my belief that eventually, once we learn enough about the Great Pyramid, we're going to discover that those empty chambers on the inside of the pyramid are intentionally designed lattice defects that incorporate, are designed that way because of the ability to manipulate the torsion waves in local space. So in other words, there's yet another aspect of this gentleman's idea, and I think he's exactly correct, that these were resonant to the planet, and particularly this is the case with the Great Pyramid.
International Line, where are you calling from? You're on the air with us.
Hi, this is Robert.
Yes.
I'm calling from Canada.
Okay, Robert, go ahead.
I wanted to touch on two subjects. One that's kind of like an underlying current that hasn't really been talked about by your two guests. And that was, the first one is that, well, all of this stuff about the pyramid and the being a weapon or an energy plant,
mm-hmm.
This must be from some sort of alien ancestry. And I remember in a previous talk show you were talking about like Sasquatch and some other aliens that's supposed to be around on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what you thought about that aspect with regards to the subject tonight. The other one was I remember hearing a story about a Dutch scientist who somewhere in the 50s or 60s bumped into a spacecraft in the Atlantic Ocean while he was on his yacht and was shown some things. One of them was the propulsion engine of this spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, he was debunked, and everybody thought he was a nut, and he ended up in an asylum.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, the pictures he drew of the engine exactly model the particle accelerator underneath Switzerland. And part of the reason why the particle accelerator is built so deep under the mountain is because when you shoot one bolt of electricity around that thing, the magnetic cores from the electricity going around would, if the tunnel was built on the surface of the Earth, may dislodge that tube by even, say, a couple of millimeters, which would cost billions of dollars to repair it. That's why they built it under Earth, to minimize the magnetic effect of pushing all that electricity around.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is if you push that electricity around in a continuous circle going around and around and around, you will create an anti-gravity field,
mm-hmm.
that the thing would lift off. And I want to know what your guests thought about
those theories. Okay, great. Aliens in the Giza Pyramid.
Well, my whole premise in the Cosmic War is, of course, that this was an interplanetary war. And as I mentioned previously, the texts seem to suggest that the human genus is not something confined solely to this planet. So if we understand alien as being sort of distant cousins of ours, I think that is a possibility that we have to entertain simply on the basis of some of these ancient myths. As for the
particle accelerator.
Yeah, the particle accelerator. I'm not familiar with this enough to be able to comment, other than it does sound to a certain extent plausible. I don't know the episode about the Dutch fellow that you're talking about, so I really can't comment any further about it.
Well, I got to tell you, the particle accelerator goes online sometime in May. We're starting to do more research on it.
Right.
There are some scientists who think that it could create black holes.
Yeah. That's been a concern all along, and I personally don't have too much of that concern, but I do think when they're building something that large, again, you know, we may be in for some unanticipated effects that they may not have reckoned in their calculations.
So true. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George.
Hey.
It's Ray from Detroit, Michigan.
Hello, Raymond. Yep.
Yeah. Was it? I was wondering to ask, like, what type of politics could planets have that they would war with each other like that, you know?
Well, that's an excellent question. And what emerges from the texts, if you read them, I reproduce a great many of them in the Cosmic War so that people will see that, you know, I'm not making this up. And I should add one more thing. I'm not making my own translations, as does Zechariah Sitchin. I am relying on academically accepted translations, by Sumerologists from the University of Oxford.
Right. I mean, that's the criticism of Zechariah's work, he's doing the translating.
Right.
You're right about that.
And I try to avoid that by using these academic translations, and even then, the story that they tell is very, very astonishing. But one of the things that emerges when you read these texts is that these ancient wars are fought precisely because of and by means of stolen technologies. It's almost as if we're reading an ancient Sumerian version of, you know, our concerns in modern times about nuclear proliferation with Iraq and Iran and North Korea. Wars are fought to prevent someone else from getting this technology and using it and weaponizing it. So the texts have this ring of truth to them that's almost very contemporary, and that's what makes me suspect that we're dealing with something very real.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, guys. This is Don in Salem, Oregon.
Hey, Don, you'll be one of the last one or two callers. Go ahead.
I kind of figured that. I'll run it by you real quick. Zahi Awas, one of my favorite people. You know, he never seems to want to admit that somebody else besides the Egyptians had created, you know, the pyramids or built all these things. And it seems to me that he just wants to quash everything that anybody else, has ideas about.
Right.
And I just wanted to get your opinion on that, and I'll let you go so somebody else can get on. Thanks, guys.
Okay, Don. Thank you. Your take.
Basically, Don, I think the answer is, first of all, that he sort of has to maintain that line because so much of Egyptian tourism, to a certain extent, depends on it. But the other thing that I think is definitely in play is that he cannot be oblivious to some of the scientific implications that alternative researchers are talking about. And I think ultimately then that the Egyptian government has made the decision that it's going to try and seek some of these things for itself. So, you know, I don't blame the man for taking the stance that he does, because it's really kind of understandable once you put yourself into his shoes.
All right, great. And, yeah, we might be able to get one more in. Let's go to our wild card line. Fred in San Antonio. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Joseph. Good evening, both of you. Good morning.
Sure.
Good morning, Fred.
I'll do it as best I can, hurrying. Okay, I went back through The Elegant Universe, Brian Greene's work, remembering some higher dimensional process. It's called a flop transition, and it allows wormholes, that are bridges in space and time. I figure that in the Philadelphia experiment, they had a device on the ship that caused the ship's atomic particles to flop transition, causing the ship to pass into hyperspace and out of phase with the rest of reality, explaining the anomaly like when you introduce a magnetic field to that said person.
Right. Right. Well, I think that there's two aspects to your comment, and the first of them is the wormhole idea. The interesting thing about torsion is it does not have to squeeze itself into the tiny, tiny dimensions of a wormhole. It accomplishes basically the same thing a wormhole does without those physical constraints.
Joseph, we're out of time.
Okay.
Secrets of the Unified Field, my friend. Thank you, Joseph.
Well, thank you for having me. You've been great. George.
Created the classic Coast to Coast show. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Jason King, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.